Hi, this is Leonard Peikoff answering questions emailed to me about Ayn Rand's philosophy of objectivism. I do this every week or two, depending on the questions I get and my own work schedule. If you want to ask me a philosophical question, feel free. Just send it to leonard@peikoff.com. And my name is spelled P as in Peter, E-I-K-O-F-F. Let's start today with a question that really wants me to give a whole science, but I will give just an indication. The question is, in Rand's novels, there is no mention of children ever. Apparently, that is not strictly true because there was mention of children in Atlantis in Atlas Shrugged. But in any event, the question goes on, what are an objectivist's views on having and taking care of children? Well, first of all, that it's certainly optional. It's not a requirement socially or to the world of, quote, family or to a woman's fulfillment, etc. But assuming that you do have a child, I'll give you just some points, not arranged in a scientific way, that I think are important. There are, by the way, some books relevant to the development of a child's mind that were recommended in the old issues of the Objectivist newsletter. So if you look there, there are book reviews, but offhand I can't remember what the titles of them. Let's take physically. I think you're responsible both for the physical and the mental development of the child. Physically, of course, for the sustenance, for the health, but I think also you should encourage the child to some extent in athletics, in sports, so he gets an idea that he has a body and there are goals that he can accomplish with it, and that he's in charge of it, and that he's not a shrinking intellectual, helpless in a world of developed boys. I think he should also be taught self-defense, karate or whatever, so that he is not, afraid of bullies and can carry himself in the physical realm confident. But that's the least of the issue, but I just mentioned that. As far as the mind and the psychological element is concerned, there are really two issues. His education and his moral character. Parent is responsible for both, and they're highly interconnected. But in terms of moral character, you have to teach a child within the limits of his age and ability to grasp some of the most important aspects of real adult ethics. You have to teach him, first of all, that there are limits, that he can't do just whatever he feels, regardless of the consequences. You have to teach him, when he is able to get to it, the idea of responsibility, that he can't blame others or say about everything, oh, it was an accident, that he did certain things and that leads to certain consequences. I reiterate, you do this on the level appropriate to the age of the person. And then again, at an appropriate age, you teach him that you don't get everything for nothing. You have to earn what you get. And he does little chores or whatever it is and gradually escalates to the point where he understands that he doesn't have something coming to him just because he wants it. Of course, you teach him honesty. You don't accept lies. Basically, most of the regular objectivist virtues are applied if they are adapted appropriately. You can't, for instance, teach him independence because he's inherently dependent. But you can teach him that, you know, when he gets to the point of thinking at all, does this make sense to you? You know, it doesn't matter what I say, etc. In some level, you can develop that. Now, some virtues are obviously inapplicable. You can't expect a child to be productive in any meaningful way because he's still learning. Now, on the educational side, of course, my primary concern would be the development of the child's conceptual faculty. teaching him to develop from the perceptual to the conceptual level. And this takes many steps. And in fact, I did a whole course on the philosophy of education, of which this was the focus. So rather than try to present it now, I refer you to that. Now I've given you just a taste, but having a child is a really tremendously time-consuming project. I had one child, halfway child, and I used to think, as a joke, with a little basis in reality, that nature made a mistake in having a child result from only two parents. There should really have been three required to bear a child because it's so incredibly time-consuming and exhausting. But that's just a joke, but you have to know what you're getting into or you're going to be really surprised. The pleasure, in my opinion, outweighs the work and the suffering, but the latter is there. And if you don't want it, don't do it. Now, I try to jump from subject to subject, so if you find one boring, the topic will change dramatically. And the next one is about labor unions. Do you hold labor unions as inherently evil? Do they violate objectivist principles? Certainly not. Not inherently evil. Not if they are voluntary. If a group of men want to get together and say, we're going to collectively bargain, all agree to go on strike, and that's their private decision, there's nothing whatever wrong with that. I think that economists have shown that the union do not inherently raise wages across the board for the total working population, but that is irrelevant. They certainly are not inherently evil. They become evil when they become sanctioned by, required by, mandated by the government, which started with the Wagner Act way, way back in the last century, early last century, and has been expanded and intensified ever since. There are a great many industries which the person can't stay in business without a union sanction required by the government. The unions have power out of all proportion to what they would have if people acted voluntarily. Now, the question goes on. My joining a union, was electricians union, was for purely monetary reasons. I don't like to make excuses, but I was finding so much difficulty in earning enough when working for private non-union shops. And, of course, the situation there is because non-union shops have the tremendous power of the government minimizing or prohibiting them. So I say in that situation you are entirely moral, completely moral to join a union. In fact, I think I had to join the radio performers union in order to be on the air. When the government mandates a certain course and the proper avenue of behavior is cut off, then you have to still pursue your value, and they have no business in keeping you out of it. But should I say, well, since the government controls the airwaves and put down the rules that you can speak, etc., therefore I shouldn't have a show? It's just like you've got to go to the post office if you want to mail a letter. The government gives you no choice. Or should you say, well, don't teach at a public college because that's something created and mandated by the government? No, of course, the government has made private education virtually impossible. So you can't let the government take over the field. The only thing you would do wrong if you joined a union would be if you advocated expansion of its functions or activities. In other words, you try to make it bigger and stronger. Then you're wrong. But if you simply go in, mind your own business so far as they let you, you're not working to advance collectivism, absolutely you have to go ahead and follow your livelihood. Now another jump. Sometimes people who have healed from an injury still feel pain because the nervous system gets stuck in some sort of rut and keeps malfunctioning by sending pain signals despite the absence of any injury. If a person could treat this type of pain by taking painkillers, what would be their incentive to do so, given the objectivist position on morality? So the idea here is, if you can live a moral life but suffer at the same time, what is your justification for ending the suffering? The answer is that a moral life is not an end in itself. A rational life is not an end in itself. A rational life leads to happiness, which is the ultimate way in which we properly experience life. And that applies to the mind and to the body. And if any pain, whatever its cause, is relievable without harm to the body, maybe no correction of damage is required, but it's because of some mistake built into the brain in that situation. Of course, it should be relieved. The idea that we should achieve life, and if it happens because our brain system is, I was going to use the wrong words, mixed up, we have a lot of bad pain, that's nothing to me. You've got to be selfish. Life, your ultimate purpose is happiness. Life is the standard. Now, it's true that in the ordinary context, pain is a signal of a harm, and that you relieve it to save your body. But in the context you cite, that's a different situation. It would be the same as my saying, exercise is great, and you should do it, but saying it to a quadriplegic, well, that would be ridiculous in that context. Let's see if we can get a couple in about music. Does personal preference denote subjectivity? My answer is certainly not. There can be good objective reasons why one person prefers one thing and one another. You can have different preferences in career according to the concrete values that you have developed. Different preferences in novels according to the types of story that you most love. Different preferences in women, down to whether they're blonde or brunette. Now, in all these cases, there is an objective value, but you have an alternative, and there is therefore preference without any subjectivity. Of course, if your preference is for murderer to read James Joyce, then you've gone into subjectivity. And now the question about music that the same person asked. He quotes two guitarists, neither of whom I know anything about, and asks, how would you figure out objectively which one was, in fact, the greatest guitarist? I'll have to answer abstractly. We're talking, I assume, as a performer. And there's two different issues here. Technically, you can judge objectively according to factual criteria that are measurable by an expert. What is his control during speed? What is his accuracy? What is the range of volume, the ability to have subtle dynamics, etc.? There's many, many requirements, and you can easily objectively judge who is a great performer and who is lesser. But the other one is, what is the meaning that one conveys? What is the emotional significance? Is one profound in the feeling of life that it gives you, and the other superficial? Now, there we do not have an objective vocabulary in regard to music. We don't have it yet. And therefore, all you can say is that on that level, I hear heroism, or I hear suffering, and that is the way I take it, and that's, I'm going to choose my listening preferences accordingly. But if two people disagree, there's no way that I know to do anything to resolve it at this time. I think work is being done in that field, but nothing much yet.
That's it for today. If you want to know more about Ayn Rand's philosophy, go ahead and ask me a question by writing to Leonard@peekoff.com, or if you haven't already done so, start by reading Ayn Rand's two most famous novels, The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged. Thanks for listening.